Welcome to the Disney Parks Podcast with your hosts, Tony Castelnova from DisneyByTheNumbers.com and Krista Joy from DisneyWays.com. Keep your hands, arms, feet, and legs inside the podcast at all times and get ready for the Disney Parks Podcast.
Our guest on the line for you today is the author of several books, and he has a unique point of view built on his passion for history, his professional training as an urban planner, and his obsession with the theme parks. Sam has performed speaking engagements at Walt Disney Imagineering, the Walt Disney Family Museum, Disney Creative, as well as many Disneyana clubs, libraries, and podcasts. Sam Genoway, welcome to the show.
I am very excited to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
As always, Sam, I love everything that you do, and this book is no different. This book is Universal vs. Disney, the unofficial guide to the American theme park's greatest rivalry, and I think it's fantastic. This is a very interesting read. If you're a Disney fan, you'll like it. If you're a Universal fan, you'll like it. So this hits both audiences, which is interesting.
Yeah. It was an interesting book to write. Really quite fascinating. Very tough book to write because it's not like Disney parks where there's a lot of information that was floating around out there. There was actually very little information that was really floating around out there. So it was definitely a fun mining trip. Put my little lantern on my helmet. Was really able to dig down in deep and found some really fun things out of it.
Yeah. I would think Universal's not as sharing with information as the Disney companies come to grow, you know, they've grown into this. This hasn't happened overnight for them either, so.
Yeah, I'm fully expecting after doing this podcast and others that that in the near future, the little black helicopters from Universal City are going to be flying over the hill to my apartment here in downtown Los Angeles, and they're going to be shining lights in it, kind of like, you know, like the Hollywood movies thing, and going, come out, stop telling stories about us. So I'm sure that'll happen at some point here, sooner or later, as far as the company goes. They are somewhat secretive as the company goes. But also, too, if you really think about it, Universal Studios is different than Disney because, you know, Disney's kind of been owned and managed by roughly the same people. And they've also been very, very nostalgic and heritage conscious. Universal has not been that way. They've gone through a bunch of different owners and everyone has its owner stamp on it. And usually the stamp is on top of what was there before. And so there wasn't this sort of corporate memory from the beginning to today that really existed with Disneyland. And that was really one of the challenges, but it was one of the really fun parts of researching this book.
So what inspired you to write the book?
It was a topic I was very interested in and a suggestion by the fabulous folks over at King Communication, who are the publishers of the book. They liked the Disneyland story, and we talked about what would be another good topic, and we talked a little bit about Walt Disney World, but that had been kind of done to a certain extent. It's a big story. After the Disneyland story, I wanted to write something a little bit smaller, which was a big mistake because that wasn't the case here. And I was utterly fascinated by Universal because within the business today, I think it's fairly safe to argue that Universal, especially in Florida, has a lot of momentum. It's attracting people that never really ever thought about going to Universal as part of their Florida trip. And now not only is it attracting them, but in many cases, they're going there first, then to Disney World, or they're not going to Disney World at all. So there's a creative energy at Universal that's happening right now. Disney's sort of making its changes going on right now. And then as I tried to understand how Universal could manifest itself in the future, I found that there wasn't necessarily a lot of stuff telling me what happened to them in the past. And hey, you know, I'm an urban planner, I'm an historian geek, so history geek, and that's how you figure these things out. So it was a good subject, and it was an eye-opener every time I was learning something new here, and there was a lot to learn that was new.
So are there simple comparisons or contrasts that we can make between, you know, Disney World and Universal Orlando attractions?
So if we were to focus on Florida, here's one of the ones that it really cracks me up every time I go there now. Look at the bathrooms. Look at the bathrooms at the Disney parks and look at the bathrooms at the Universal parks. You see, Universal Studios in Florida wasn't really supposed to happen. It was really a product of a guy named Jay Stein. And Jay Stein was the guy who was running Universal Studios for Hollywood. And he really wanted to take what was in Hollywood, which was a movie production studio that had a tour built around it, and build the same thing in Florida. And that was what he was really trying to do. And so he convinced his bosses, Sidney Sheinberg and Lou Wasserman, to invest. Now, they weren't really very excited about investing in this whole thing. They just thought, you know, if you want to do it, we have 400 acres in Hollywood. We haven't used all that yet. So you could buy 400 acres if you could get it at a really good deal, just as a real estate transaction, because, hey, you know, we got a lot of money. Jaws came out. So it was Jay Stein's vision of doing a Florida park. And so when Michael Eisner decided to move forward with the Disney version, and Disney was going to be basically Universal Studios Hollywood, but built around the tourist need, the respect to the tourist, to the guests, which is the Disney hallmark, Universal had to come up with something kind of different, and that's what they did. So, Walt Disney World is very, very suburban. Everything is big and spread out. Universal is very urban. Everything is compact together. When they designed Universal Studios Florida, they had a team of people who went out and counted every single stall in every single bathroom at Walt Disney World, and they made sure that their bathrooms were bigger. So if you think of it, there are 12 million toilet stalls at the Universal parks. They're much bigger than the Disney ones because you never should have to wait. And since they're almost all e-ticket attractions or big attractions at Universal, which was a difference, they were designed to be very high capacity, so you never had to wait in as long of a line. And then there was the biggest difference is at Disney, you want to be sort of warm, fuzzy, reassuring in general is why people go there. And that Universal, it's built around this concept that Jay Stein had come up with, which got later named the J-Bang, which is that to him, what makes people really excited is when you do something and then you get scared and you get that and then that kind of nervous little laughter that comes with it. You know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
That's very memorable. That's very memorable. And Jay Stein was a huge fan of the Universal Monsters. And he thought that the power of the Universal Monsters is that as an audience collectively, you scream, you laugh, and then you giggle, and that's very memorable. And so that's the defining difference between Disney and the Universal attractions. The Universal attractions were designed around this idea of having a Jay Bang, which was that thing that just makes you go, oh, wow. And all the Universal attractions, as you go around, you think of it, they all have that. So Terminator 2 3D, the J-Bang would be when the seats drop out. I hope nobody, I'm spoiling anything here, by the way, but I figure it's been around a couple of years. But when the seats go down and you're enveloped in smog, I mean, that you still, don't you still applaud? You know, and you don't do that in any 3D movie anywhere else. There's a J-Bang at Universal Studios Hollywood when you see the Waterworld show. You know, when that plane comes flying at you, I don't care who you are, you have to giggle and laugh, and that's just really quite memorable. So that's another one of the differences between the two companies. I believe it used to be another significant differences is that you were always somewhat in a place that was functional at Universal. Islands of Adventure was their first foray into fantasy, and now they're fantasies in both parks. So that's something that's going to be kind of the same in both parks, is it's all going to be about fantasy environments. So we'll see what happens with that. That's a big change. That's very different for Universal.
I always found that too, you know, even the queue lines have, you know, different feels. You know, Disney will kind of, you know, weave you. You're not really sure where the beginning is and the end is. And Universal is kind of always like military style front, you know, it just zigzag back and forth. You can see where the front was, you can see where the back was.
You're right. They other than, you know, let's take Harry Potter as an exception, because that is a very different, that's designed very differently. Everything about Universal is, it was based off of an industrial tour. I mean, ultimately, Universal Studios was the world's greatest industrial tour, who sort of got pushed into being a theme park competitor to Disney because of Disney pushing them into that. That wasn't really what they wanted to be. They loved being that. They loved the idea that they were able to churn those trams in Hollywood around every 3 minutes. They can't even do that today. And they were just blowing through those so that people didn't have to wait very long. You know, the whole design conceit for Universal Studios Florida is that no ride would ever have a line longer than 45 minutes. And every ride was, you know, King Kong, E.T., Jaws. These weren't like little teeny rides. These were the big E-ticket attraction rides. So, that's a different, very, very big different vibe between the two. And the idea of customer care, you know, Disney was built on it's their cast members, they're on stage or off stage, they're all putting on a show, everybody roles important. At Universal, if you ask around, somebody might remember to call themselves team members. Many of themselves call themselves minions right now, because that's sort of vogue over there. It's not so touchy-feely to the guests. You know, we want the guests to have a good time, but if the guest is going to be really kind of a jerk about it, you know, go to Disney. You don't need to be here, you know. We don't need to hide our lines. It's like a movie, you know what? Our favorite movies, the lines went around the blocks. You didn't complain about Star Wars. You tell your grandchildren you did that. So that's kind of part of the Universal attitude as well.
And I also think my other comparison between the two things is, once you're at Disney World, Florida, you're immersed in the experience. You can't see the outside world. You don't even know there's an outside world. And Universal is a little bit different. They don't, you know, you can peek and see the outside world somewhat.
Yeah, but I think that's becoming less and less so. Yeah. I think that as the park and the resort develops, especially as they now are building a berm at the hotels, the idea of being able to convey a very compact resort environment is definitely there. And I want to give kudos to another one of those names you don't hear about very much these days, a guy named Barry Upson. Barry Upson was the guy who was the first general manager of the Hollywood tour and was able to make that function. And then went on to work on all the both of the Florida parks. He's the next time you're looking at the San Francisco area, you're going to see a sign that says Upson and Company. That's named after Barry. And he's the one who came up with the idea of the waterway, the canals, with the idea that it would be a lot easier to move very large groups of people using water and keep the resort fairly tight so that they could avoid the very suburban experience of Disney World, where people had to go long distances between destinations, that he could make the transportation a destination of itself with boats, kind of what Walt wanted to do with monorails, but Disney sort of fell through on that, and it's also a lot cheaper to buy some boats going in water than it is to build monorails. And you know what? I think it's really saving Universal too, because, you know, Disney has to maintain a bus system about a small-sized city or a medium-sized city, and that's very expensive. And Universal has, what, 4 boats right now? Yeah. 5 boats. So yeah, it works.
Very true.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like
other things that are different, you guys find is a comparison between the two.
You go first, Tony.
I just think the experiences are completely opposite. You know, like I said, I think one is, you know, this all immersive. I'm in a park, a resort, a hotel, and I feel like there is no outside world. I don't know what day it is. I don't know what time it is. There's no clocks. There's no newspaper. There's nothing. And Universal, I kind of don't get that warm and fuzzy that you're talking about. It's, you know, a little bit colder experience.
Yeah. And I would say that's completely by design. Disney is all about respect for people, reassurance, creating an environment where your lizard brain can kind of churn down a few notches. Right. Universal, especially in Hollywood, because it was a movie studio and it was a tourist attraction shoved into a working movie studio, and that attitude still pervades in Orlando. It's very edgy. It's not very relaxing. It's better than it is in Los Angeles, but you know, you can't walk, even when you walk through their city wall in the morning at a time when there's nobody there, it still feels very energetic. And Universal, it's going back to that J-Bang thing. It's going back to that, make you go, ooh. Universal doesn't want you to necessarily take a deep breath and relax. Certainly not in City Walk.
Yeah.
There's not like a place where you can sort of sit and people watch in City Walk if you really think about it. It's very tough to find a place just to sort of sit and hang. And Universal Studios Florida, other than what was one of my favorite parts, which is the little the Central Park section that nobody ever goes in. It's because nobody ever goes over there. It's very quiet and relaxed. Universal Studios Florida has very few places where you can sit and relax, and the best places tend to be the back lot sets that people don't wander through very much, or that Central Park. And Islands of Adventure is brilliantly designed with a built-in relaxing spaces. The only the most Disney spot in all of Universal Florida, I believe, are the little peninsulas that come out at Islands of Adventure, where you walk beyond where the major attractions are and they go right down to the water. And and for those who know what I'm talking about and have explored that, you find you're very rarely, there's very many people that are there. That's the most Disney experience, where you can go and sit and relax and look across the water and look at movements and stuff like that. But no, they really are designed for two different things. Universal wants you to be aggravated just enough so that you're alive, you're awake, you're just a little bit scared, and you'll pay money to save yourself. And Disney wants to lull you to sleep and nowadays hang you upside down and go and take your money. I'm sorry, did I say that? No, there goes my press pass again.
Okay. All right, so let me ask you, Sam. I get mad as soon as I go to Universal because I have to park probably 3.5 miles from the front entrance. I have to, you know, then take these escalators and go through this whole parking garage. You know, back in the day when I first started going there, I used to park right in front and walk to, you know, the Universal Globe.
Yeah, that's right.
And now there's, you know, two parking structures, you know, 5 stories tall. It's crazy. So have they made that? Is that now part of that, you know, experience they're trying to, you know, the cold and edgy thing that they're trying to build there?
Well, the idea is as a park once, but you know, if you really think about it, it's from a planning point of view, it's sheer genius. The most urban planners would suggest that Plaza San Marco in Venice is the greatest urban space that you can go to. It's very magical. But one of the things that it does have is it's the crossroads. You have to go through it to go to something else. That's the great magic with City Walk. Is City Walk, whether you're staying at one of the resort hotels or you're staying off-site, everybody has to share that experience of City Walk before they go off onto their adventures. They can't really just go directly into the park. And because of that, they get eyeballs, see everything twice. They see it coming in and they see it going out. And so it's a huge financial success. It's got to be more successful than Downtown Disney, which is, although generally very well themed over the various years, it still is not in the middle of where you're going. So it's a destination, and it makes it much more difficult. So it's part of the urban ethic. You know, in the suburbs, you want to be kind of quiet and a little bit with nature. That's Disney. You're in the middle of a city at Universal. They want you to be sort of amped up and hyped. I mean, have you ever tried to make a phone call at Universal? It's impossible.
Yes. Tony, we have a good story about that.
Go.
We were hoping to record a podcast, even though I was at Universal on a field trip with my son because I got him free. We had scheduled an interview with Lonnie Burr, an original Mouseketeer, and thought that I could just phone in and we would do the interview. No, there was no signal.
No, and there's no place to go that's quiet. Everything, and it's, you know, it's like the guys who do the sound over there listen to Spinal Tap way too much, and everything's up to 11.
Yes.
That's another contrast between the two companies. And where Universal was sheer brilliant is in the sound design of Islands of Adventure, because although it's still loud, it's the first theme park designed with the stereo soundtrack in mind. And they use the sound, especially like in Toon Lagoon. You know, Toon Lagoon, people tend to walk through it really fast. Next time, walk through through it really slowly and go through both sides, walk along the storefronts, it is the greatest sound collage, because every door reflects what the theme is of that door melded into the soundtrack. And the moment you walk away from it, it fades, and then the next element starts to appear. It's just sheer genius, the sound design in that part. But in that particular area, I spent a lot of time in that area. They're two very, very different experiences. They should ultimately be somewhat complementary to each other. And my hope is, of course, that people will just go longer trips to Florida and they'll just spend more days at each place. But, you know, that's up to Disney and Universal to keep coming up with neat things that make me want to spend an extra night there.
Right. And can we just go back and talk about Harry Potter for a minute? Because I heard that Disney could have had Harry Potter, but there was trouble between them and J.K. Rowling. Is that true?
You know, there has been a lot of speculation, and this has obviously been very tight-lipped in negotiations and stuff like this. And I like to be a historian and not a speculator. So here's what I know. That Universal had already had a relationship with Warner Brothers going back to the Cartoon World design days, which was going to be the second gate in Florida. It was going to be a theme park based around DC Comics superheroes, Batman, Spider-Man, Superman, that kind of stuff, and DC Looney Tunes characters. So Bugs Bunny and the Roadrunner and things that were like that. Before the first film came out, Phil Hedema, who wrote the foreword to my book, had pitched J.K. Rowling and Warners a stage show featuring Harry Potter characters that would have used a lot of the technology that Universal pioneered in their Conan the Barbarian show, which was really the first show of its kind with all sorts of special effects blended in together. And at the time, Rowling and Warners, the property was still new, the movie wasn't out, they declined to do the show. So I know that that had taken place. Of course, with the success and the wonderful intellectual property that was the characters, everybody, I'm sure, wanted to go and fight for it and pitch for it. Disney certainly would make a valiant try, but Universal was in kind of a unique position. First of all, if you really wanted to control your intellectual property and you're going to do business with Disney, you have to come to grips with the recognition they have a long time history of doing this stuff, and they've learned some really good lessons, and they probably have something to say. Universal, on the other hand, was always very reflective of the international intellectual property, and then when the property got old, they had no nostalgia. It was like, give it goodbye, Fred Flintstone, Barney, all you Hanna-Barbera characters, you're all, you're out, you're gone. Nickelodeon, you're in. Oh, you're gone. Minions, you're in. They had no nostalgia. So they're a little bit different there. They were also owned by General Electric, and they were doing really bad, the parks. So I believe Universal was in a position to reward Warner, which was probably as concerned about the financials of it, and the control to J.K. Rowling that she would have demanded to see the intellectual property protected. And most importantly, what it did is the circumstances forced everybody to use Stuart Craig, the set designer, and that was, to me, the brilliant moment, because what happened is that Universal benefited from the same lessons that Walt Disney did with Disneyland, which is, if you're a set designer, you design it to feel a certain way. If you're an architect or a planner, you design it to function a certain way. So when I, as a planner, think of a store, I think of how many people I want in the store, what square footage, and how do they move, and stuff like that. When you're a set designer, the store is the size that the store is because that's what the story calls for. And so Universal had to kind of go along with making these stores that were extra small, and Rowling and Warner was taking advantage of the fact they could create a universe of products that would supplement the stories, because the stories were so rich in those. And they did exactly what Walt did, is they used set designers to create environments so you could walk through the sets. And that feels a lot different than walking through a modern day themed environment now that we're a few generations away. So that was Universal Universal's big score. I'm sure that Disney was a serious player, but in the long run, because of the watchful eye of Warner and Rowling, the acceptance of the people at Universal, knowing that they had a very strong intellectual property they really believed in, they came up with exactly what they needed to. And when you read the newspaper reports from before Harry Potter opened, today you think it was a no-brainer, it was going to be a big success. There was a lot of doubt in the amusement park industry that this thing was going to succeed. And it just blows me away that, oh my God, will there be legs? You know, will people really care about Harry Potter and stuff? But they hit it out of the park. It's terrific. And I have my magic wand. Do you?
No. No. Not me personally. We're the Disney Parks podcast, so.
I went in a little experience at Ollivander's on an early morning, kind of off season as a hotel guest. It was raining. I stood in line. I was told, go do that first because the line gets really long. I stood there. Everybody peeled away from me, and I was the only person going into Ollivander's, and everybody in the crew was cracking up because it's like, first of all, they never have it with just one person, or very rare, and certainly not with somebody as old as me. And so the wizard guy comes up, oh, you're a wise old wizard to get here by yourself, you know, and they had some fun with that. And you know, and then by walking out, the lady secretly whips in my ear going, you know, if you really don't want the wand, just leave it on the counter. And I'm like, oh man, you kidding me? It picked me. I have to have this wand. So it sits proudly on my bookshelf, my magic wand. So sorry, Disney podcast. Sorry about that. But you know what? A lot of you guys are going over there and spending a day. I've seen all you Thing 1 and Thing 2 t-shirts on your children. I know which parks you're visiting first before you go to Walt Disney World nowadays.
That's true. Very true.
So true. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So how did Universal get from California to Orlando? What's the story on that?
It really was that Jay Stein guy. Right after Walt Disney World opened, Lou Wasserman, who ran MCA, which ran Universal, had Buzz Price do a location study to learn a little bit more about the Florida market. Buzz did that. At the time, they decided not to buy property. Lou Wasserman was really big into SeaWorld. He really wanted to buy SeaWorld and tried it a couple of times. So that got them looking in the Florida market as well. And then Jay Stein convinced him and said, you know, we really should be positioned just in case, and there might be labor law changes, because Jay Stein used to be the guy who helped producers and directors in Hollywood figure out which soundstage or back lot facility they needed to do their show. So he knew how shows were broken down and created through physical location. So he was really the perfect guy to run these things. And he thought that maybe labor laws in Florida would be such where they could build a Hollywood studio, do film production in Florida, and then just like here, they can end up doing tour buses and stuff like that. Now, that was his first inclination, and Lou Wasserman, they were flush with cash from Jaws. They found a really good property that was going to be a shopping mall, so it was already zoned for all the traffic and stuff, and it was really pretty cheap for the amount of acreage, and the acreage was about the size of the Hollywood facility, which was about as much money and land as Lou Wasserman wanted. So they bought it, and then Lou Wasserman said, okay, Jay, you know, if you want to do this, if you want to do the studio thing like that, fine, go ahead, except for, you know what, I'll tell you what, you got to find a partner, you got to find somebody else that believes in this as much as you, that will go into it with us for 50-50. And they did that for two reasons. One is they figured if somebody else is willing to pay for half of this, that's just fine with us. And then also it's because, you know, it's kind of a Jay Stein thing. It wasn't what they did, and it was kind of up to Jay to show them that he had to do this. So he tried very hard to find a partner. One of the first guys they went to go talk to was the president of Paramount Pictures at the time, a guy named Michael Eisner. And Michael Eisner was really good friends with Sidney Sheinberg, who was the president over at MCA. And they went in with a really fancy show that showed what they were going to do and the land that they had and how they were going to build a tourist-friendly studio. And they were going to bring all this Hollywood production to Florida and stuff. And Eisner was interested. He liked it. And now today he says, says and states publicly that he wasn't at the meeting that he was at, but you know, the sources that I have demonstrate pretty conclusively that he was at this meeting, and he at least learned about the parks. Now, his parent corporation, Gulf and Western, wasn't really interested in the idea of a partnership, so it kind of lay dormant. And then Jay Stein was knocking on every door. He was off to every movie studio that was in Hollywood that would listen to him and open up to the door, but nobody would do it. And so his poor thing was kind of floundering. And then Eisner and Frank Wells become the head of Disney, and immediately, we talked to him about this thing while he was at Paramount, and he was interested. Maybe Disney and Universal, perfect. You know, we've been rather complimentary and pretty friendly to each other here in California. We've stayed off of each other's shows. Universal, very much by design, did not want to compete with Disney. They didn't feel they needed to. They were making too much money kind of doing their own thing. And that's where they had left it. And then Eisner told his guys over at Universal, his friends over at Universal, you know, hey, that's neat, you know, but I think we're working on something of our own. And that's where it all started. And it became a case of where MCA felt betrayed by Michael Eisner. And because they felt betrayed by Michael Eisner, and Michael Eisner felt that he was doing the right thing for the company he was working for, and it was a smart business decision on Disney. It was basically Michael Eisner telling Lou Wasserman, I'm going to beat you, and Lou Wasserman trying to remind Michael Eisner that he was a bigger deal in Hollywood than Michael Eisner. And that's what got the whole thing started. It has really nothing to do with anything else other than a power play between two giant Hollywood moguls. Isn't that so unromantic of a story after the Disney stuff?
You know, it's interesting. There was the Disney Wars book by Stewart, and then I also read Work in Progress by Eisner, his version of his side of the story. And so I really believe that it was Michael that really kicked these theme park wars into high gear.
I think you're right on that one. Yes, very much so.
He did not like to lose at anything, really. And he did not want to see any competition in the Orlando area, and he was just going to squash Universal.
I think that's pretty. Now, one of the things that Universal did discover, much to their chagrin, is they were interested in the production facility portion of it. Yeah. That was a serious contender, because that would have been the reason why Wasserman and that's the reason why Wasserman would want to build in Florida. Now, ultimately, and I haven't really gotten to that part of the story, is that the fact that Steven Spielberg sort of found out about Universal's interest in theme parks didn't hurt any either. That became a big motivation.
Sure.
But Eisner's idea as a marketing guy, and this is why, you have to look at it from a pure business play. He knew that Universal was interested in doing this in Florida. He knew that Universal was really struggling finding a partner, and that they wouldn't pony up the money to do this until they found a partner so that Disney could preempt them. That Michael Eisner had been working in Hollywood and certainly had seen what Universal, the success they had on the hilltop. So he figured the idea that Disney could do better than Universal creating a tourist-friendly facility. Even Universal knew that if Disney was going to do this and they were going to do a tram tour, they were going to do it much better than they ever could. That's why they had to rethink the whole idea of what the park was. That's why it stopped being an industrial tour, which is what they knew, and they had to sort of become a theme park competitor, which is something they really didn't want to know, but now we're all of a sudden forced into doing that. So, yeah, Eisner really woke up the sleeping giant. I do believe that if Eisner would not have built the Disney MGM studios or push it forward so fast, I don't see that there was any momentum of a partner coming to MCA, and I do think it would have been fairly likely that Universal probably would have sold off the property or transformed it into some sort of a use that was different. Because when they started researching the studio space, they knew they needed at least 4 sound stages worth of business to make a studio work. They couldn't figure out more than 2 sound stages worth of business in the entire state, which is why nobody ever used the Disney studios, because there wasn't the need in the state of Florida for this kind of facility. So yeah, it's once again, I'm going to be clever. I can build this first. That's going to push them away from the market, but they just underestimated Lou Wasserman and Sid Sheinberg and Jay Stein going, I can solve this problem for you. I can build something that's bigger and better and has more bathrooms and bigger hot dogs. And that's Universal versus Disney. It's that kind of silliness.
Yeah, and you know, Universal was part in California, really a studio with a tram tour. But then when they built Hollywood Studios, Disney, they built almost the same thing. They built, you know, a working lot with a tram tour.
Yeah, that's what they wanted. They wanted to build what, because the thing that was in here in Hollywood was very, very successful. I mean, not only was the studio doing well, but the studio tour cost very, very little to operate and was making money hand over fist. And it was the genius of Albert Dorskin and Harrison Buzz Price and Barry Upson 50 years ago to figure out how to monetize the back lot. So not only could it be used for film production, but it could also have supplementary income through this industrial tour, because at the time every other Hollywood studio was selling off their back lots for real estate plays. So 20th Century Fox was building Century City. The Warner Ranch was becoming offices. So all these things were becoming these dense offices, and back lots were going away. So it was absolutely brilliant that they figured out a way of making money on an asset that was derelict for every other movie studio. And they were very happy with their industrial tour. There's a lot of information in the book about studies that they did, that they wanted to make sure that they never had to compete directly with Disney, because that's a very expensive proposition. And I'll give you a quick example. There was a study that talked about the shows and how to do shows. And they did an economic study that showed that because of the professionalism of the shows at Disneyland, and remember this is like the mid and early 60s, that the expectations of the guest kept rising, and it became more expensive to put on the next show because people expected something bigger. Now, by having participatory shows like at Universal, where the guests become part of the entertainment, the general audience's expectation is generally lowered, and you don't have to have nearly as a professional of a show, because you're mostly laughing at and with the people that are interacting on the stage, because that could be you. So it didn't cost nearly as much to do the shows and the production, so they could churn them around much quicker to reflect whatever is the current intellectual property. So whether it was Adam 12 or it became Emergency or it became Airport, it was the same basic show with a few little tweaks, because it was still, you know, getting people wet and throwing things at them, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So Sam, in your opinion, what do you think? Are Disney and Universal friends, enemies, frenemies? How would you classify that relationship?
You know, if I was going to continue with this theme of things are personal, I suspect that they may be even somewhat today. The folks that run Comcast are people. The person at the top is a person who used to work at Disney and was very well respected and did wonderful things with Disneyland Paris and getting it on a proper financial footing and the Disney stores. And he had an opportunity to rise within the Disney organization, but that was denied him. Went over to Universal, went over to Comcast. We tried to buy Disney, and that didn't quite work out very well for them. And Eisner used the theme parks as one of the reasons why they shouldn't be over at Comcast. And then they bought Universal. And I think that the folks that run the parks at Universal these days are pulling a page out of the Walt Disney playbook and doing it very well, which is to create a unique environment that immerses the guest in a reality that they couldn't experience elsewhere, provide them with a large-scale attraction that uses high capacity, that's memorable, so that people write back to their friends, you got to do this, this is really neat. Support that with secondary attractions that reinforce that primary theme that drew you there in the first place, and then make additional money by per capita by having retail goods that support the story and can only be bought there. That was very much the Disneyland model and the very early Disney World model, and that's what Universal's doing. They're doing. I mean, the genius wasn't building and expanding Harry Potter at Universal Studios Florida. The genius was slapping up the Transformers before it opened, so that you can have a capacity of a couple thousand people per hour that are now standing in the line in Transformers as opposed to clogging up the aisles over at Harry Potter. It's a very old school way of running a theme park that was developed by Imagineering in the past. I don't think that the two companies are necessarily friendly with each other, but you know what? I don't really deal with the officialdom of either of the companies because I write books that have the unofficial guide on the title of it. And so it's not like the publicity departments at Universal or Disney are like sending me invitations and stuff. And when they do, I still have to reject them. So I'm not in there. I'm not in kind of that sort of universe of writers. So,
all right. So thinking about the future of Universal Orlando, I think they're in the same position as Disneyland. They're kind of out of space to expand and grow. What are their options?
You know, they got a lot of land.
Do they really?
Oh, there's a lot of land there to build stuff. Yeah. If the Comcast executive team could go back into the Back to the Future time machine and turn the DeLorean, they would have turned the clock back to the Vivendi days and would have bought. They would not have sold off 2,700 acres that they used to own that they ended up selling off because during the one of the fun things about Universal stories, they've gone through so many owners. And each owner has sort of laid its own little imprint upon the company. They had bought 400 acres, and they bought a bunch of land, and then they sold off a bunch of land, and now I bet they wish they had it, and then they got some land back again. There's still a lot. There's still a lot of room to put more hotels. There's still a lot of room to put other attractions. Now, I have to say, I'm a historian and a planner. I'm not a speculator, and, you know, what are people doing in the future? I don't get myself wrapped up into that whole game. But on a physical space, sense, there's plenty of land to build additional hotels and attractions. I think they demonstrated with the miniature golf course that they can take underutilized areas and create attractions that are very attractive because, you know, you don't see a lot of people playing necessarily the Disney miniature golf courses unless they've been there for like a week. At Universal, all of a sudden you walk over it every time, so I think people tend to like it a little bit better. It's sort of there easier. So there's that, and if you look around the perimeters of the parks, there's still quite a bit of land. Go to the Halloween event at Universal Studios Florida, where most of the mazes are backstage, and you can see there's plenty of land back there to do stuff. Plus, Universal is not very nostalgic, so if an intellectual property becomes old and decrepit and nobody cares, you know, say goodbye to it. It's not going to last very long, you know. I give the Minions like 10 years unless they turn into Mickey Mouse or something like that, and it'll be something else, because that's what the trend has been over there.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that mini golf at Universal. I call it the golf underneath the freeway.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's like in the weirdest place in the world. I'm like, they put mini golf underneath the freeway?
But you know what? If you went to Walt Disney World and your listeners, you guys write in and you tell these guys, how many of you knew that there were miniature golf courses at Walt Disney World? And the ones that I'm really talking about is a lot of you probably passed the one that goes by that's next to the water park, right? Because it's next to the water park. But the other one that's over near the Swan and Dolphin, I bet if you ask people that there were, did you know that there are two miniature golf courses in Walt Disney World? They'd go, well, I know of the one over here, but I didn't know there was the other. Ask a person that goes to Universal, did you know that they have a miniature golf course? Yeah, I walked under it. It was underneath the freeway, as you say. So, you know, it's from an urban planning point of view, it's like everything else at Universal. It's claustrophobic. It's supposed to get on your nerves. That's Universal. That's a J Bank. That Disney's supposed to make you relax. You're not supposed to relax at Universal.
Okay. If you want to hear more of these great stories, Sam's got them all written down. You don't have to talk to us. Go buy his book, Universal versus Disney, The Unofficial Guide to America's Theme Park Greatest Rivalry. We'll post all the links where to buy it on the show notes so that you can find the book.
Excellent. Thank you. And it's also going to be an audiobook. They just started recording the audiobook. So for you joggers.
Are you reading it?
No, you know what? I recognize because they did an audiobook for the Disneyland story, and I had thought long and hard about it because I've been told that I have a voice that could do this sort of thing. I thought long and hard, and I thought if I read my own book in my own head, I'd be re-editing it, and I would not be satisfied because as a writer, you know, you never are ever really satisfied with what what you do. At just some point, you have to stop. And I thought as I was reading it, I go, you know, I'd restructure that sentence slightly differently now that I know. So no, there's a very, very talented gentleman who does this for a living that's going to be reading the book. So it's kind of cool to have an audio book. I think it's neat.
You should have gotten a Disneyland attraction voice to do it. That would have been fun.
Well, not for the Universal book.
Yes, it would.
That probably would work. I'd get a Universal guy, maybe, but you know, that might have worked. But he'd have to have like a, you know, I have to say, if there's like a tenor of the voice of the Universal book, the guy would need to sound a little bit more like this, a guy from The Sopranos. Because ultimately, the story of Universal, it's not warm and funny. It's not warm and fuzzy. It's very much of a, yeah, this is what we're going to do. I'm not going to name names, but now that you've mentioned it, I talked to a lot of the designers, first-person designers. So unlike Disneyland book, these guys are still alive. And I was able to talk to a lot of them. And yeah, there is a tone in all their voice, a sort of, you know, man, I was in the trenches with a little squad that we had, and we fought the good fight, and we came out of the dunghole, and we did it. We fought it. So it'd have to be that kind of hard scrabble voice, because that's a universe. Voice. I never thought of it that way before, but yeah, thank you for bringing that up. That's why I'm here. You guys surprise me more than anything else. All right, give me another plug, please.
Well, I just want to say, that as far as the media for Universal goes, I've been to some media events at Universal on behalf of a really big website, and they are so kind. They roll out the red carpet. They treat us so well. And then when Tony and I send an email to Disney PR, we don't even get a response. So I got to say, it makes it hard, you know, not to want to support Universal a little bit more, because they are so much nicer to.
I think that, and I've gotten feedback from folks at Universal, you know, especially the designer guys, especially, were very, very good, because, you know, they're very proud of the work that they've done, and nobody's really written about them before, you know. And so a lot of the Universal people and a lot of the people who work there today, they don't understand the whole lengthy corporate history. And so this is a chance to sort of unpeel the onion a little bit. And the book is very positive to Universal, I will confess. It's a hard-fought thing, but I think it's a very complimentary book, and it makes you really respect what was happening over at Universal. So I would hope that these people wouldn't be mad or angry with me. I hope they read the book and they would like me. On a matter of ethics, I don't do these sort of press junkets and stuff, because that's the slippery slope that drags you down in it. I did go to one event at Universal as a friend of a person that worked there, and a couple of people, because I'd worked at Universal Studios Hollywood for like a few months, just because I always wanted to work at a theme park, and it was, the economy had crashed, and I was working on the Disney book, and I wanted to get firsthand experience. So I actually worked, and I was a stage manager at Terminator 2. I learned how to push the buttons to make sure people don't die. It was a lot of fun, and I wouldn't do it for a living, because it would drive me crazy, but it was fun for those few months. And so I went to an event at Universal, and their publicity team was just completely confounded about me and didn't want to help at all. And they had a guy come up to me going, I don't want to talk to you. I'm going to be watched. And so I went, oh, well, okay, fine. So there's one person that's in the book that was just so rude to me for no reason, that he got credit for only one thing that he ever did. And it wasn't a positive comment, because, you know, it's what you get when you get to write the history of these
things.
That's
right.
You get that final word. So, but yeah, please tell your Universal people that I actually really like the company and the book's very positive and they should like me.
Okay. Well, we like you. We appreciate you so much, Sam. And I think
like the Disney people too.
We've had you on the show, Tony and I, once, and I think you were probably on the show another time with John and Tony, right? So your third time appearance here on the Disney Parks podcast. We are Sam fans for sure.
And the last one was just about almost a year ago to the day too. So it was very, very close to the
year. I noticed that. Yep, almost to the day. So
my life is now complete. I've done just like the Matrix and the Shrek films, and no, Pirates is now four films, isn't it? Well, you can bring me back if I do another book or something like that.
and hopefully sooner. So thank you so much for your time. We just appreciate you so much. You're awesome. So we're going to put everything in the show notes so everybody can pick up your books. And we just want to thank everybody for listening. We'll see you in the parks.
The Disney Parks Podcast is not affiliated with the Walt Disney Company. All Disney parks, attractions, lands, shows, event names, etc., are registered trademarks of the Walt Disney Company.
Like a moon out of the blue, fate steps in and sees you through one reach upon a star.